is the idea is to complete the sort of survey of the most important organizing patterns in the standard model, which are sort of essential for understanding why it's organized the way it is, but really no one has explained where these patterns come from yet. So actually, before I move on to lecture 10, there were, recall, as usual, there were two slides at the end of the previous lecture that I didn't get a chance to finish explaining, so let's do that. Okay, so, well, let me just to briefly recap. Remember, we were first going over the SU5 pattern, that in brief we want to show that that the exterior algebra lambda C5 transforms under SU5, that if you restrict SU5 to the standard model subgroup, SU3 times SU2 times U1, that lambda C5 exactly breaks into one generation of fermions and antifermions in the standard model. And so first we described how to embed the standard model gauge group in 5x5 unitary matrices. And then we introduced what the exterior algebra was. Okay, so in n dimensions, the exterior algebra over complex vector spaces, we start with Cn, and then we were taking anti-symmetrized products of two or p basis vectors to get the two forms or the p forms respectively. And then the total exterior algebra is the sum of, direct sum of all those zero forms, one forms, et cetera. A total dimension 2 to the n, and so we're going to say, okay, the one that's going to be relevant for the standard model is lambda C5, the exterior algebra in 5 dimensions, which has the right dimensions to describe one family of fermions and antifermions in the standard model, and we wanted to see how that actually worked. Okay, so before we can see in detail how that works, there's one more thing I should explain, which is the following important duality that applies for any exterior algebra, which is that if you look at how this subspace, the subspace of P forms in n dimensions, how it transforms under SUN, and then you look at how the subspace of n minus P forms, the sort of dual subspace, how they transform under SUN, they transform like complex conjugate representations of each other. Okay, they're the same representation, the same dimension, but they transform. But if one transforms with one representation matrix, the other transforms with the complex conjugate of that representation matrix. So here I was just going to derive briefly, or I'll sketch the derivation, let's say, so that, which again I encourage you to kind of check later these steps in more detail, because it might go by a little fast here, but it's very easy to check. So just remember that we're talking about how SUN, how an element U from SUN, how it acts on the exterior. Well, first remember SUN is defined as n by n matrices having two properties. They're unitary, meaning that U times U dagger is equal to the identity matrix, and they have determinant 1. Okay, so if I just kind of put back in all the indices here on these matrices, well, the unitarity becomes this statement that uij times u bar jk is equal to the identity matrix delta ik. On the other hand, the statement that the determinant is equal to 1, well, if you just think about how to write out the determinant of a matrix in terms of all of its components, making it explicit, it's really saying that if you take ui1 j1 times ui2 j2 times dot 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 up to uin jn, and you anti-symmetrize that sum by contracting it, you anti-symmetrize over the I indices i1 through in by contracting those indices with an epsilon tensor, that the answer is either 1 or minus 1 or 0, depending on whether the j indices in the sum, which were not anti-symmetrized over, either formed an even or odd permutation of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to n, or if there were any repeated indices, then you get 0. Okay, so this is just, if you think about it, the determinant you know and love expressed in a possibly unfamiliar form. And then what you can do is just using this first identity, you can multiply from the right by contract from the on the right hand side by so now suppose oops. So suppose I start from this identity. Identity, but then I now multiply both sides of it on the right by, well, I multiply both sides of it by u bar j n I n, by one copy of u bar basically, and I contract, you know, one of the indices on my u bar with one of the indices, with one of the hanging j indices in this equation. Well, on the right hand side, I'll end up with just an extra factor of u bar, but on the left hand side, I'll get to use this identity to convert one u bar and one u into a delta I k, which will then subtract, it'll end up just subtracting one of the u's from this side of the equation. So now I have n minus one u's on this side of the equation and one u bar on this side of the equation. And I can keep doing that again and again, and by just repeating that and again, it just check that you, it's easy to check the details in a minute or two on your own. It's probably one of these things that's better to check on your own. Just by contracting by u bars on both sides, it's like you keep moving a u from the left hand side over to the right hand side where it gets turned into a u bar. So, you know, I could do this again and again and end up with p u's on this side and n minus p u bars on this side. Why does that imply this sort of duality relation that the p forms transform like the complex conjugates of the n minus p forms? Well, think about, for example, a 2 form. Okay, so this guy transforms as a 2 form. So it's like a tensor with 2 indices. It transforms with 2 copies of u under an SU5 transformation. So it transforms like this. Fine, so now imagine we define corresponding object with 3 indices, which I'll call psi bar J1 through J3, by taking my original 2 form and contracting it with an epsilon tensor, contracting its 2 open indices, J4 and J5, with 2 of the indices on the epsilon tensor, leaving the remaining 3 indices. Oh, sorry, I should have said. So in a moment, so far I've been speaking generally, letting n, the dimension of the vector space Cn, be free, but to be concrete here, I'm going to specialize to the case we're going to be interested in a moment, which is when n is equal to 5. So here I've taken a 5 component epsilon tensor contracted with 2 form to get this thing with 3 indices. So that's a okay. So let's see how this guy transforms, given how we know this guy transforms. Well, it transforms to, well, the epsilon doesn't transform, but the phi picks up, transforms like a tensor, like we just saw. But then if we use the identity we used a moment ago, oops, there's a typo here, this should have a bar over it. So if we just use the identity we derived above, relating an equation with 2 u's and an epsilon to an equation with 3 u bars and an epsilon, we can then rewrite the first line as the second line, where I now have 3 u bars instead of 2 u's. But then now I can rewrite, combine this phi and this epsilon into psi bar. And so I have an equation for how psi bar transforms. And I see that it transforms it does indeed transform just like a 3 component guy, but like the complex conjugate of a 3 form. Okay, so sorry, that's what I'm trying to say is that if we have a 2 form, then that transforms like this, then by redefining it with an epsilon tensor, we can equivalently think of it. It's ultimately the same representation. We can go back and forth between that way of looking at the representation and the other representation where it's a 3 form, an n minus p form in other words, but that transforms with u bars instead of, transforms like a complex conjugate representation instead of like the original representation. Okay, so with that fact, let's now see this how the claimed fact, how does lambda C5 break up into the standard model representations. I'll just go through it here, but again, I recommend taking 15 or 20 minutes of your life at some point shortly after the lecture to go through this yourself. You'll thank me later. You'll remember it when you're old and on your deathbed, and you'll think, oh, that's one thing I did in my life. Really worthwhile. Wow. So, you should definitely do it. And okay, so good. Here's our representation of a U5 matrix. Remember, we're not taking a general 5x5 unitary matrix. We're going to look at the standard model subgroup, which is this sort of 3x3 and 2x2 block diagonal matrix with an element of SU3 times SU2 times U1 embedded like so. Okay, and so what you can see is that, you know, it naturally acts on a element of C5, it's a 5x5 matrix, and so it acts on a 5 complex component vector here, but it's not going to mix up all 5 components of the vector because it's block diagonal, so it's only going to mix up the top 2 components, which I've called V here, and the bottom 2 components, which I've called W. Okay, so C5 is going to break into a direct sum of a 2-dimensional subspace V and a 3-dimensional subspace W under the action of the standard model subgroup. So let's see what happens to each of the different, so I'm just going to go line by line and look at what happens to the 0 forms, 1 forms, 2 forms, etc. And it's actually going to be less, it's going to be, you'll see it'll go quicker than you might think. What first the 0 forms, well, no problem. The 0 forms are a 1-dimensional vector space, so the 1-dimensional irrep of SU5 is the trivial irrep, so this is just a 1-dimensional, secretly, just a 1-dimensional vector space that doesn't transform at all, under SU5. So now when we split SU5 into the standard model subgroup, when we split it up in this way, well, it didn't transform before. Of course, it's still not going to transform under a subgroup. So this guy just doesn't transform, and so in our notation that we introduced last time for rewriting the standard model table, that means if we write it as a tensor product of an SU3, an SU2, and a U1 part, the SU3 part doesn't transform, the SU2 part doesn't transform, that's why I have a 1 here and a 1 here, and the U1 part doesn't transform, that's why I have charge 0 here. Okay. So if we look at if we went back and looked at our list of all the different standard model representations that we wrote next to our table, we could ask, is this one of the items on the list? And we would see, oh, actually, yes, it's 2 of the items. This could either be the right-handed neutrino or the charge conjugate of the right-handed neutrino. They both had this transformation law. And for later purposes, we'll see, we're going to want to identify this guy with the charge conjugate of the right-handed neutrino, the right-handed antineutrino. Okay, so we found the right-handed antineutrino. And now as we go through, we want to see that we find all of the standard model particles and no more, no less. Okay, so let's go now on to the 1 forms. So these guys transform like a vector under SU5. But now when we, so they transform with 1, you know, the 1 forms have 1 index, so they get hit by 1 copy of our U5 matrix. But now if we look at how the U5 matrix breaks up, well, actually, the vector it acts on, the 1 form that it acts on, that's the 1 form is exactly this vector. It breaks into 2 parts, 1 subspace V and 1 subspace W that don't get mixed with each other under the standard model. So it breaks up into this subspace V and this subspace W. And if we ask, how do those 2 subspaces transform under the subgroup? Well, again, using our standard model notation, our new notation for the table, well, if you look at V, look at how V transforms here. Well, it get, it get, it gets hit by an SU2 matrix. Okay, so I'm gonna, so its SU2 representation will be a doublet. It doesn't get hit by an SU3 matrix. The SU3 matrix is down here. It's gonna hit, W will get hit by an SU3 matrix, but V does not. Okay, so under SU3, V transforms like a singlet. It transforms like C to the one. And then it gets, V gets hit by 3 powers of alpha here. So in other words, it transforms with, it's under U1, it transforms with charge 3. Okay, so that's how V transforms. What about W? Well, W does get hit by a U3 matrix. So it does transform like a triplet under SU3. It doesn't get hit by the U2 matrix, which only hits the top subspace B. So it transforms trivially, like a singlet under SU2. And then, oops, another typo. This should say, alpha. Now it gets hit by minus two powers of alpha, so it transforms with charge minus two. Remember, alpha is just an element of U1, it's just a complex phase. So this guy is getting hit by, if alpha is e to the I phi, then W is getting hit by e to the minus two I phi, which is why I say it has charge minus two. Okay, so again, if we looked back at our list at the beginning slide, if I looked back at our standard model table, we would see that V is nothing but what we called the antiparticle of the left-handed lepton doublet, and W is nothing but the right-handed down quark. Okay, so here we go. This is actually the last line that we have to work out now, because the remaining ones will all then follow by our duality principle. So this is the last little bit of work we have to do. How do the two forms of C5 transform under the standard model subgroup? You know, under SU5, they transform again with two copies. They have two indices, so they transform with two of these U5 matrices. And now we just want to ask, okay, so if we break, but C, again, because the U5 matrix is block diagonal, C5 breaks up into these two subspaces, V plus W. And so, well, here's an identity which I want to use on the first line here for how two, you know, if I have the two forms over some vector space C5, but then I break that vector space up into a direct sum V plus W, then you can check, if you just think about the definition of what a two form is and what the direct sum means, you can check, and you should check, to make sure you understand what I'm talking about. Oh, sorry, one other thing. So what happens is that the two forms over V plus W, well, that decomposes as the two forms of V plus direct sum with the two forms of W plus the space V tensor W. So really, we want to just figure out how does the standard model act on these three spaces, the two forms of V, the two forms of W, and the V tensor W. Okay, so the two forms of V, well, since V doesn't transform under SU3, the U3 matrix doesn't talk to V, the two forms built of V also won't transform. So they transform like a singlet under SU3. Under SU2, will V transform like a one form, like an ordinary SU2 one form under SU2? It's just hit by one copy of U2. So V will transform just like an ordinary two form of SU2, the two forms of V will transform like the two forms of SU2. But by our duality principle, that's the same as the complex conjugate of the zero forms of SU2, which is trivial. So this guy does not transform under SU2, actually. If you then think about how does it transform under U1, well, so one copy of V gets hit by alpha cubed. So now if I take the tensor product of two copies of V, it's going to get hit by two copies of alpha cubed. So it's going to get hit by alpha to the sixth. So under U1, this guy will transform with charge 6. Okay, and if we look at our list, that's nothing but what we previously called the antiparticle of the right-handed electron. What about lambda W? Well, it's sort of the reverse story. Lambda W doesn't, just like W doesn't get hit by the U2 matrix here, W in the lower component doesn't get hit by U2, so the two forms of W also don't get hit by U2. They're just a tensor product of two copies of W. So under SU2, they don't transform, just like W doesn't transform. They transform like C to the 1. What about under SU3? Well, W transformed like a 1 form under SU3. So the two forms of W transform like two forms under SU3, but by our duality result on the previous slide, that's the same as transforming like one copy of SU3, the complex conjugate of SU3, one copy of U3 bar. So in other words, they transform like the 3 bar, or the C3 star representation in our earlier notation. And then what about under U1? Well, one copy of W gets hit by two powers of alpha to the minus 2. So two copies of the two forms get hit by four powers of alpha to the minus, get hit by alpha to the minus 4. So they have charge minus 4. If we look in our table, that's nothing but what we had previously named the right-handed up anti-quark, charge conjugate of the right-handed quark, right-handed up quark. And finally, V tensor W. Okay, well, how does it transform? Well, the V gets hit by one copy of U2, whereas the W... So now I'm having trouble spitting this out, but... So under SU3, if you look at the U3 matrix, well, it does hit W once. It doesn't hit V, so it hits an element of V tensor W once. So under SU3, we transform like a C3. Same goes for SU2. If we look at the U2 matrix here, it hits V once, it hits W not at all. So it hits V tensor W once, so this transforms like a doublet under SU2. And finally, if we look at how many, you know, V... V gets hit by one power of... gets hit by alpha to the 3, W gets hit by alpha to the minus 2. So the product of V and W gets hit by alpha to the 3 times alpha to the minus 2, which is alpha to the 1, which is why we have charge 1 here. If we look that up in our table, that's what we had previously called Q left. And now we're done because we've worked out the 0 forms, 1 forms, and 2 forms of SU5. But then our theorem on the previous slide says that the 3 forms, 4 forms, and 5 forms transform like the complex conjugates of those representations. So in particular, we could do the analogous working out for the remaining 3 lines, but instead we'll just use the fact that lambda 3 just transforms like the complex conjugate of lambda 2, lambda 4 transforms like the complex conjugate of lambda 1, and the 5 forms transform like the complex conjugate of the 0 forms. So what we get are that, you know, so the complex, so if this guy would transform like the right-handed antineutrino, the corresponding 5 form will transform like the right-handed neutrino. If the 1 form is transformed like the anti-left-handed lepton doublet plus the right-handed down quark, then the 4 forms will transform like the conjugate representation, the left-handed lepton doublet and the right-handed down anti-quark. And then similarly here, I won't try to make myself say all the words correctly, but if the two forms transform like this, 3 forms transform like the charge conjugate particles here. And so if you just go back to the first slide and look at, so we have here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 different representations. If you look back at the first slide, you'll see those are exactly the 12 representations that appear in the representation of one standard model family, F, plus the corresponding antifermions. And in particular, if you look more closely, you'll see that, remember, F was all of the one family of left-handed spinners transformed. you'll see they exactly correspond to how the even forms transform here. So the zero.
Something up.
The bottom of the board cuts off.
Thanks. So yeah, they transform so that the left-handed spinners in the standard model transform like the even forms, the zero forms, two forms, and four forms of C5. And the corresponding anti-spinners, the right-handed spinners of one generation, transform like the odd forms, the one forms, three forms, and five forms of SU5. Okay, so there you go. It's beautiful.
Can you explain again for the two forms why is there a tensor product, B and W, and the
Well, let's see. It'll be good to sit down and think this through yourself. But so just to sketch the reason, you know. Remember what lambda two C5 is. It's all combinations of the five basis vectors E1 through E5. All pairs of those, but anti-symmetrized. So suppose that you took two basis vectors which were both drawn from the basis vector. Suppose E1 and E2 are the basis vectors for V, and E3 through E5 are the basis vectors for W. So suppose your two basis vectors that you chose to take were both from V. Then you would get exactly the definition of that subspace would span exactly this. If they were both chosen from 3 through 5, you would get exactly this. But now if you took one from 3, one from 1 and 2, and one from 1, 3 and 5, then the anti-symmetrizing doesn't reduce the dimension. It's not like when you normally anti-symmetrize and you took 1 with 1 minus 1 with 1 and that just went away. Because they're being drawn from those two different spaces. So it's as if the anti-symmetrization doesn't matter. It doesn't reduce the rank of the vector space at all. And so it just ends up being. Yeah.
Does this mean these are not all the possible two forms of C5? The special way you wrote.
These are all the possible ones. It's just that we've split them up into, somehow a theme here with this whole pair of lectures is about how, you know, when you look at some representation under a bigger group. So it's how some vectors, if you look at how the vector space on which that representation acts, the irreducible representation mixes up all the vectors in that vector space, but then under the subgroup, when you act on it with a subgroup, it's not that the dimension of the vector space has been reduced in any way, the vector space is still as big as it was, it's just that it gets broken into subspaces that only transform amongst themselves. So that's what's happening here. We have the space of all of the two forms, which transform as an irreducible representation under SU5. But now if you ask, how do those two forms break up into irreducible subspaces when I don't act on it with an arbitrary SU5 matrix, but only on this subcategory of special SU5 block diagonal matrices corresponding to the standard model subgroup? Then there's still the same dimension of P forms here. All the P forms are still here. It's just that they're transforming into these three subspaces without mixing them. Okay? Yeah?
I have a bit of confusion because when you were proving the duality thing, was that n the dimension, like the SUN, or was that the dimensionality of the
group? Oh, good question also. Yeah, that was the, so here n, yeah. So little n here runs from 1 to capital N. So when I'm looking at, yeah, sorry, it's a notational screw up here. So that this should say, this should be SU little n. So in other words, we have the basic vector space is C to the little n, and so it has a natural action of n by n matrices of SUN acting on it. And the whole exterior algebra then inherits that action because it's just tensor products of that. So it transforms like some tensors under SU5. So is that Clear? Okay. Okay, so there you go. That's the end of SU5. Okay, let's see. So there was a question. There was a question last time about whether the standard model really transforms under the full. How do you know if it's the full SU3 times SU2 times U1 mod Z6, or whether it's a smaller subgroup? And so let me briefly say about that, that if this whole SU5 pattern is correct, it actually is a subgroup. And so you can see that as follows. So here's our element of standard model gauge group, element of SU3, SU2, and U1. And when we map it into SU5, into a 5 by 5 matrix, we did it this way, we said. So now suppose, consider the special case where we don't just take an arbitrary element of U1, but we take a sixth root of unity. So we take one of the six complex phases on the unit circle, e to the 2 pi I over 6, or integer multiples of that. So integer powers of that. So, and moreover, instead of taking an arbitrary U3 matrix, let's take the U3 matrix alpha squared times the 3 by 3 identity matrix. Notice that since alpha to the sixth is 1, this matrix does have determinant 1. So it is an element of U3. It is an example of a U3 matrix. And also consider the U2 matrix, the SU2 matrix, alpha to the minus 3 times the 2 by 2 identity matrix. So that is indeed a unitary matrix, a special unitary matrix, because the determinant here is 1 because alpha to the minus 6 is 1. So we're going to consider a special, there's six special elements of the standard model of the full group SU3 times SU2 times U1. There's six special elements of this form corresponding to the six sixth roots of unity. But if you now just take this element and plug it in to this 5 by 5 form according to this rule, you'll see that all six of these special elements actually end up getting represented by the 5 by 5 identity matrix. So in other words, they become trivial. And so that is saying that, you know, if this whole SU5 pattern is correct, then secretly the true global structure of the standard model gauge group is actually SU3 times SU2 times U1 mod Z6. So it's this big manifold, but actually secretly for every point on the manifold, there's six image points that are really that have all been identified. And actually, if you look, it's a bit of evidence that SU5 might be on the right track, is that if you look at how the, if you look back at the standard model table and ask, how do all the rows transform under this special, one of these six special elements, you'll see that all the particles in the standard model don't transform. They all are inert under it. So it's consistent with the fact that those special elements are all, should be identified with the identity matrix. They do seem to act trivially on every field of the standard model. Okay, so good. So there you go. That's one of the great patterns in the standard model, and there's two more that are really worth knowing about, and they're all related to each other. So somehow they're all part of the same big picture. Do you have a thumbnail? Question? Okay, so good. So basically I wanted to tell you about the other two, which are spin 10, which is even more unified than SU5. SU5 was the smallest simple group with one component in which the standard model group SU3 times SU2 times U1 fit. So we fit the standard model into it. So we unified the gauge group, we unified the symmetry group, but then if we took our six different irreducible representations of fermions and asked how unified did they get? Well, they didn't actually get completely unified because they got grouped into this very elegant object, the exterior algebra. But it did not transform like a single unitary group, like a single irreducible representation of SU5, because the zero forms, one forms, two forms, etc., all transform separately as irreducible representations of SU5. Okay, so we had not like unified the fermions into a single irreducible representation. So spin 10 is the simplest group that does that, it's one step higher, it's one rank higher than SU5, contains SU5 as a subgroup. So I just want to explain how that works, because that's also a beautiful thing. I would say probably the most important pattern to know about. So let's again consider our same lambda Cn or lambda C5, but I'll show. So what I want to show you first is that if you have the p forms in n dimensions, that those are very closely related. Okay, so the exterior algebra in n dimensions is very closely related to the spinners. In 2n dimensions. Okay, so lambda C5 is very closely related to the spinner in 10 dimensions, which is why spin 10 is going to provide an even nicer unification scheme. So let's see why it is true for a general n here, before we specify to the case of n equals 5. So there's a nice argument for why it's true. So what I want to do is I want to define two operators that act on this vector space. So the first operator, the first type of operator, aj star, so where j runs from 1 to 5, or j runs from 1 to n, is the creation operator. So if I take an element of lambda cn, then all it does, it wedges it with one more, with the basis element bj. So if I started with a p form here and I wedged bj with it, then I get a p plus one form. If I started with a p form here, I would get a p plus one form here. But the wedge product, if you've never met it, is just if you take a p form and a q form, there's a way to take a product of them to get a p plus q form. And all you do is you think of it writing it in tensor notation, where a p form is a tensor with p indices that are antisymmetrized. And if I have one p form a indices on, 1 through p, and one p form b with indices 1 through q, I 1 through iq, the wedge product is where I just multiply those two tensors and then re-anti-symmetrize the indices. Okay. So now it has p plus q indices, but they're anti-symmetrized. Okay. Yeah, sorry. Let me first remind you that EJ is my name for the basis elements in CN. So CN was all linear combinations of E1 through EN. Psi is an element of lambda CN. Okay, so it's a vector in this vector space, the exterior algebra. And now AJ star is an operator that I'm defining on this vector space. So it's a linear map from this vector space to itself. So if I give you any vector psi in this vector space, this linear map maps it to a new vector, EJ wedge psi. And so that defines how the matrix acts on this vector space. Psi is an element of this vector space. Okay, so that's called the creation operator for J. There's also the annihilation operator for J. So how does that work? Well, to tell you how that works, it's helpful to look at a particular simple type of vector psi. So if I take a particular vector, which is just a single wedge product of some string of basis elements, EI1 through EIP. So So it's a p, it's this special p form with just one term in it. Then AJ acts on it as follows. So AJ kind of walks through the list here, okay, and if it encounters an EJ, it eats it and removes it from the list, okay, and otherwise leaves the list unchanged. But every time it passes, every time AJ has to pass through one of the E's, you pick up a minus sign. So here what I've shown is that so if AJ walks through the list, it passes the first K minus one guys, because they're not EJ, but then it finds that the element EIK here is actually a J. So in other words, if the subscript IK was J, then it just removes that element. So AJ has walked past E1 all the way up to EI sub K minus 1. So it's walked past the first I sub K minus 1. It's walked past the first K minus 1 E's in the list because they didn't have the right subscript. But then at the kth element does match. So it just removes that kth element from the list. And then the rest of the list is just left unchanged. So that's what happens if this term, that's how AJ acts if this term does include an EJ. If it doesn't include an EJ, then this operator just gives zero, just gets angry and kills the term. To describe it more violently than I should have. Yeah, so that's the definition of how the annihilation operator acts. You can see how it's kind of like an annihilation operator, which when it's acting on a state in a Fock space, if it encounters a one particle in a Fock space, it removes it. But if it doesn't, if it encounters a state that doesn't have any particles of the desired type, it kills that state. Okay, so in particular, you can now check. I recommend checking. It's a simple exercise to check that if you've defined AJ and AJ star this way, that they obey these anti-commutation relations. So if I consider AI times AJ plus AJ times AI acting on any state psi in the Hilbert space, it always annihilates it. It always equals zero. And similarly, if I consider the creation operator AI star times the creation operator AJ star acting on any vector in the vector space, any vector psi, again, it kills it. So you should check, make sure you understand why that is true. But meanwhile, if you calculate the anti-commutation relation of the ith annihilation operator with the jth creation operator, you know, AI times AJ star plus AJ star times AI, it gives delta IJ. In other words, if you act on any vector psi in the Hilbert space, when A and J are the same, it ends up just leaving that vector alone, doing nothing. But if I and J are different, it kills it. Okay, so, but you probably recognize these anti-commutation relations as the anti-commutation relations for the AI and AJ. AI star and AJ are like the fermion creation and annihilation operators. These are the annihilation and creation operators for creating n different types of fermions. Okay. So good. So now, how is it related to spin 2n or spin 10? How is it related to spinners in 2n dimensional space? Well, to see that, I want to use these operators to define a new set of operators on the same vector space. So, lambda 2i and lambda 2i minus 1. So if I take the ith creation and annihilation operators and I add them with an I, I'll call that the 2ith gamma operator. And if I take the ith annihilation operator minus the ith creation operator, I'll call that the 2i minus 1 gamma. So in other words, in this way we produce all of the we define, because I runs from 1 to n, we've defined now gamma operator is running from 1 to 2n. Okay. And if you just use these annihilation operator, if you use these anti-commutation relations, you'll see that the gamma matrices satisfy these anti-commutation relations, that the anti-commutator of gamma mu with gamma nu is equal to minus 2 times the identity matrix delta mu nu. But that is just the commutation relations for the so-called Clifford algebra. You probably met this sort of algebra in when you met spinners for the first time in QFT, except in that case, instead of delta mu nu, here you had the Minkowski metric, eta mu nu. So if mu ran from 1 to 4, and there was an eta mu nu on the right-hand side here, this would define the usual Dirac gamma matrices, gamma 0 through gamma 3, this algebra. But more generally, if mu runs from 1 to anything, and you have the metric for you have the metric for flat space time with p plus signs and q plus and q minus signs, this same algebra defines this defines the so-called Clifford algebra in p comma q dimensions. The spinners in p comma q dimensions are nothing but the representation, the unique irreducible representation of this Clifford algebra. So that's how you define, you know, spinners. We of course know and love spinners in our own 3+1 dimensions, but they exist perfectly well in any dimension, just like vectors, you know, can be defined in any dimension. Spinners can be defined in any dimension and space or space-time, an arbitrary number of space directions and an arbitrary number of time directions. And so in particular, here what we're getting is the definition of the Clifford algebra for spinners in 2n space dimensions and 0 time dimensions. So in other words, 2n dimensional Euclidean space. And if you think about it, you'll see that that these operators, so what we've said, well, the vector space that these operators are acting on and satisfying this algebra on is exactly this vector space, lambda cn. So we've shown that lambda cn is a representation of the 2n-dimensional Clifford algebra. In fact, if you think about it, you'll see that these gammas really mix up all the different vectors in this vector space, so it doesn't split into any subspaces. So this is an irreducible representation of the Clifford algebra in 2n dimensions. But there's a famous theorem that there is only one irreducible representation of the Clifford algebra in any dimension. There's a unique spinner representation in any dimension, Dirac spinner. And so that's what we've found. We found that lambda cn is an irreducible representation of the Clifford algebra in 2n dimensions, 2n dimensional Euclidean space, i.e., it is nothing but the Dirac spinner in 2n dimensions. And to say a little bit more about what I mean by that, you may have met this fact also, or maybe you'll meet it for the first time now, about spinners when you learn about them in QFT. You know, you introduce the Dirac gamma matrices, and then you check that if you take the commutator of two Dirac gamma matrices, define that commutator, gamma mu with gamma nu, to be j mu nu, then the different j mu nus, and then you can then use this relation to calculate the commutator of j mu nu with j alpha, use this relation and also these anti-commutation relations for the gammas. You can check that j mu nu with j alpha beta, its commutation relation looks like this. but this is exactly the commutation relation defining the generators of the group S at SO2n, so the rotation general rotations of two-dimensional Euclidean space. Or if we had done the same thing with in Minkowski space, these would be the general rotations of SO3(1). In other words, these would be the generators of the Lorentz group. Okay, but in our case, they're the generators of SO2n. And then if you think about it a little bit more, you'll see that actually the J's, that although the gammas mixed up all the different vectors in this vector space, so this was an irreducible representation of the Clifford algebra, the algebra of gamma matrices. Gammas can take you between any two vectors in this space. If you look at the J's, because each J involves two gammas, and each gamma is made from one annihilation and one creation operator, you'll see that each J only takes even spinners to even spinners, even forms to even forms, or odd forms to odd forms. So under the J's, or in other words, under the rotation group SO2n, or its fancy spinner double cover spin 2n, the Dirac spinner breaks up into two irreducible representations. Well, this is something we already saw when we were dealing with our actual Lorentz 3+1 dimensional spinners in our table. We saw that the Dirac spinner is a four-component spinner, but it breaks up into an upper two components, which actually are an irreducible representation of the Lorentz group, and a lower two components. So this is the analogous thing, but in any even dimension, that same thing happens. So in 10 dimensions, the Dirac spinner in 10 dimensions breaks into two different pieces, each of which has half the size. And those are the left-handed Weyl spinner in 10 dimensions and the right-handed Weyl spinner in 10 dimensions. So, to make a long story short, what we've shown, and again, I encourage you to go back and check all the steps here. Again, same comments about your deathbed apply. What we've shown is that the Dirac spinner, if you look at how the Dirac spinner transforms so there is this unique representation of the Clifford algebra in 10 dimensions. It's a very important object, the Dirac spinner. If you ask how it transforms under, why am I having trouble saying this out loud? So what I'm trying to say is that this guy is exactly one copy of F plus F star. It's exactly one generation of fermions and antifermions in the standard model. And in fact, under spin 10, spin 10 is the fancy name for spinners. There's this fact, that they don't transform under SO3, they don't transform under the rotation group SO3, they transform under the double cover of the rotation group. It's called spin 3. That's the fact. You have to rotate by 720 degrees before you get back to the identity matrix. So there's a similar thing here, that this guy doesn't transform under SO10 exactly. It transforms under the double cover of SO10, where you have to rotate by 720 degrees around in any plane to get back to the identity, called spin 10. Okay, so a single generation of fermions and antifermions is exactly the Dirac spinner of spin 10. And so in particular, it breaks up into two Weyl spinners of spin 10. And the interesting thing is that the even Weyl spinners exactly correspond to the left-handed Weyl spinners of this Dirac spinner, 10-dimensional Dirac spinner, exactly correspond to the left-handed spinners of one generation in the standard model, where notice those are two different notions of left-handed spinner that are for some reason coinciding there. There's left-handed with respect to this group, but then there's left-handed spinners. What F we had originally defined was that they were the left-handed spinners with respect to SO3(1), the Lorentz group. So for some reason, those are matching. And then similarly, the corresponding antifermions, the right-handed spinners of spin 10, are exactly the right-handed spinners of one generation of standard model fermions. When we break down, when we restrict to the SU5 subgroup of spin 10, then this 16 breaks up into the 0, 2, and 4 forms of lambda C5, and this 16 bar breaks up into the 1, 3, and 5 forms of lambda C5. And when we now further restrict to the standard model subgroup, we get exactly our table of 12 representations, F plus F bar. So in other words, to make a long story short, in spin 10, we have succeeded in taking our original table. We had this original table, which consisted of, which had 3 columns and 16 rows, and now it's been reduced to a table with 1 column and 1 row. So it's just the governing group is spin 10. There's only 1 irreducible representation for the fermions, and they transform in sort of the only it's also been cleaned up in one other crucial aspect, which is that if you think about our original table, like with SU2, et cetera, SU2 had an infinite number of irreducible representations to choose from, 1D, 2D, 3D, 4D, et cetera. And there was a question of why did we choose the 2D representation? Why does the standard model use the particular representations it does? Well, this table is a little more explanatory. Spin 10, you know, secretly is really just the, is coming from the Clifford algebra, and the Clifford algebra only has 1 possible irreducible representation. So that's the representation that appears here. So it's a huge, vast cleaning up. As usual, I have run out of time before the last slide where I tell you about Patty Salam, but that's very quick. I'll do it next time to try to stick to my rule of not going over. And then we'll move on to talk about a whole bunch of more physical things about the renormalization group in the standard model, quantum chromodynamics, asymptotic freedom, confinement, etc. A whole bunch of things. A whole bunch of fun stuff all crammed together in the next lecture. So anyway, you can see, you can imagine how that'll go. But no, it's all going to work. It's all going to fit. It's going to be good.
Okay.
Yeah. Any questions?
What about the Gauss boson representations in spin 10?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So, you know, let's see. That begins to almost get into an aspect of the topic that I was going to shunt into the, I should say, you know, I was going to say at the end of Patty Salam, you know, if you want to understand kind of ideas, the best ideas, there's a very interesting story about what the physical implementations of these ideas are and, or what the hypothesized physical interpretation of these patterns are in terms of grand unified gauge theories. And in that case, you know, so each of these groups, SU3 times SU2 times U1, that's a 12-dimensional manifold. It's a 12-dimensional Lie group that comes from a 12-dimensional Lie algebra, exponentiating 12-dimensional Lie algebra. Each of the generators of that Lie algebra, each basis element of that Lie algebra, in a gauge theory has an associated gauge boson, which is why there's 12 gauge bosons in the standard model. Now, when we stick this standard model gauge group in these bigger groups, then if the right interpretation of that is that they are all coming from, that it's coming from a bigger gauge theory with a bigger symmetry, then that bigger gauge theory would have to have, again, 1 gauge boson for each generator of its gauge group. So for SU5, that it would have to have 24 gauge bosons, twice as many as we actually see, and the other 12 would have to be, for some reason, hidden from us, maybe because they're too massive to have yet been produced at a particle collider. So that's one possibility. And it's still always the case that the gauge bosons always transform as the adjoint representation of the, that's a thing that's forced upon you by the structure of the Engels theory. So they always transform as the adjoint representation of whatever symmetry group is the gauge group of the theory. So for spin 10, the adjoint is 45 dimensional, there would be 45 gauge bosons, and et cetera. So that's a normally, you know, I think of that as a problem, standard interpretation. It's not necessarily that it's ruled out, it's not that it's wrong, but just that the standard interpretation of what these symmetry patterns mean in terms of grand unified theories requires you to imagine that there's a whole lot of other stuff that we don't see, and you have to work pretty hard to, in various ways, to make sure you hide all of that stuff to explain why we haven't seen it. And so one thing you have to do is you have to imagine that that they're hitting very high energy scales, and there's this, and it looks like there is a, well, that introduces a puzzle about why there is this vast difference in energy scales between different the scales in the standard room. That scale is in like a weak scale. So it's a whole interesting story. I really recommend that whole fascinating story about the various positive and negative pats on the back from experiment that idea has gotten and how it might be decided in the future, et cetera. That I think that I'll discuss in the standard model course. Yes.
If our symmetric group was SU5, then we know that SO10 would be the real algebra of this SU5 group.
Say it one more time. If it was
if
SU5.
Our symmetric group was SU5, then the real algebra would correspond to this SO10 or like double covered thing that you were describing. But we know that our symmetry
correct one thing here. So the way it's usually the way the naming convention works is that you know every Lie group, let's call it capital G, you know if you look at the tangent space above the identity of that Lie group, that's a Lie algebra with the same dimension as the manifold and so let's call that Lie algebra little g. So usually the Lie algebra. And that Lie algebra is given the same name, but usually lowercase. So for for the Lie group SU5, the Lie algebra is usually written as little SU5. And for the Lie group SO10, capital SO10, the corresponding Lie algebra is little SO10. So just that one clarification. Is that? I just wanted to make sure that clear that.
But like we know that the symmetry group is not exactly SU5, it's a smaller subgroup of SU5, which was that SU3 times SU2 times U1 mod Z6. Then it
right.
means that like this irreducible representation that we have for SO10 actually has some redundancy inside that doesn't correspond to, I mean like not every part of it is physical, it corresponds to physical symmetries that we see in the world.
Yeah, that's right. So the good news about spin 10 is that if you look at the size of the representation, this 32, its representation is it acts on a 32-dimensional vector, which breaks into two 16-dimensional vectors, and every one of those particles is a physical fermion in the standard model. So one nice the good news about spin 10 is that you fit all the matter particles in the standard model into one irreducible representation, and that one irreducible representation has no more or no less than the particles in the standard model. Period. It's just that they can now transform into ways that in ways that we don't actually see them transforming together in nature. But the bad news is, like you say, that. Because the symmetry group spin 10 is a lot bigger than the actual physical subgroup SU3 times SU2 times U1 that we seem to see, you're left with a puzzle. Why is that? You know, so the question is, what is the right interpretation of that? So you know, one interpretation is what you were saying, that the remaining 45 minus 12 generators of spin 10 are redundant, or they just don't act for some reason, or something kills them. Another possible interpretation is that they are physical symmetries of the standard model, but just that are spontaneously broken at energy scales high enough that we haven't observed them yet. Like once upon a time, we would have said, well, historically this is an anachronism, but nevertheless, if people knew what they knew now, but had lower energy colliders than they have today, then there would have been an earlier epoch in our history where we would have said the symmetry group of the standard model was SU3 times U1 electromagnetism. We wouldn't have known, except by this sort of theoretical argument, we wouldn't have known that the actual symmetry was this bigger SU3 times SU2 times U1. And in that case, what happens is that, you know, what happened was that as you get higher energy colliders, you began to actually produce, there were actual physical gauge bosons corresponding to those new gauge symmetries. It's just because of the Higgs mechanism, had to have a pretty high energy collider before you could actually see them, before you could actually produce them. So one possibility is that all these other redundant or unphysical gauge bosons, maybe they are physical, But again, it's just you need an even higher energy collider in order to produce them. As I've hinted, that idea, I'm not personally so, I wouldn't bet very much personally myself on that idea. Although it's not definitely not ruled out, and it has some had some successes and some failures, basically. I'm more inclined to think that there is this pattern which is too good to be a I think that the status of things, as I understand it, is that there is this pattern, or couple of related patterns in the standard model that are just, you know, they're too nice to just be a coincidence. So the answer, that's just a coincidence, I think is implausible. You know, if I was like a detective, you know, trying to solve a case or something, it seems like it can't be a coincidence. But what is the interpretation? I think that that's a very much an open question. I'm kind of personally inclined to think that there's some nicer, more subtle interpretation of why somehow there's a governing bigger symmetry, and yet the physical symmetry you see at low energies is some smaller thing. But I wish I could tell you I knew what that was. But definitely the most fleshed out idea are these grand unified gauge theories. That just imagine that it's analogous. It's another rung on the ladder that leads from the low energy standard model to the full standard model to yet another higher level with less symmetry broken.
When you describe everything with a spin 10 group, which the Clifford algebra is given by a Euclidean metric, does that mean that the Minkowski metric naturally arises somewhere? And the steps that we are breaking that spin 10 to smaller groups?
No, not in this context. So in this context, you know, this, you know, there's, because the issue is that there's, you know, external symmetries and internal symmetries, space-time symmetries that actually move you in space-time or rotate you, and then symmetries that are internal, and so they just rotate. They do nothing to space-time, but they somehow just rotate the particles living above each point in space-time into one another, as if they were like extra dimensions or something like that. But they're not, but according to the usual interpretation, they're not actual space-time dimensions or something like that that are being rotated. They're just some internal rotations of fields. So the Minkowski metric, the 3-1 metric, that's the metric on space-time, and rotations of it are, you know, SO3-1 are space-time symmetries of the standard model, and then, you know, and then as far as we know, it is some separate internal symmetry group. There is this theorem called the Coleman-Mandel. So the first thing to say is that SO3-1 is not a subgroup of spin 10. Unless you complexify, because you can't have, you know, spin 10 only has 10 plus signs. So basically, if you take a subset of those, the subgroups you can get are the subsets of those plus signs. If you have 10 plus signs and no minus signs, then as a subgroup, you could consider the group just as the subspace with 9 plus signs, or 8 plus signs, or 7 plus signs. You can see the subgroups of spin 10 would be spin 9, spin 8, spin 7. You can't get spin 3-1. As a subgroup of spin 10, because there's no minus signs in the original group. Again, if you want to treat the whole thing as a bigger complex group where you let the parameters of the gauge transformation be complex numbers, then that complex spin 10 does have spin 3-1 as a subgroup. You could wonder about whether maybe you could somehow fit the Lorentz group into that. And there are other interesting schemes that have attempted to combine, find a bigger symmetry group that contains both the gauge symmetries and the Lorentz group as subgroups of those symmetries. That would be a dream, really. That would be some sort of unification of gravity and the rest of the forces. Famous difficulty with doing that. Not that it won't work. I mean, something like that probably ultimately will work. Someone will have the clever idea that will somehow make it work. But there's this famous Coleman-Mandula theorem that says that, you know, if you try to make a quantum field theory which combines gauge symmetries and space-time symmetries, as two subgroups of the same larger group, that you get violations of unitarity. The theory you define under rather general assumptions. Now, famously, supersymmetry was discovered as a loophole to those assumptions. So, and there are loopholes, and, but there's this rather general problem you have to figure out your way around. That you usually get a sick theory if you try to combine the Lorentz group with the other non-space time symmetries. All right.
Thank you.
Sounds good. Yeah. See you next time.